You're listening to the CryptoCast podcast.
Welcome to the Crypto and Blockchain Talk.
Hello.
Hey.
Guten Tag.
Aloha.
Hola.
Shalom.
Hallo.
Namaste.
Ni hao.
Vivet.
Hello.
Salut.
Yassas.
Salve.
Ciao.
Bonjour.
Our podcast talks about the latest trends in the worlds of cryptocurrencies and the blockchain.
And welcome to this week's edition of Crypto and Blockchain Talk, where again I have the wonderful Jonathan Dunsmore. Hello, Jonathan.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Oh, thank you for joining us. We are going to be talking this week about Quadriga CX because I find it fascinating. So gather round, boys and girls. It's story time. So Quadriga CX was founded in 2014. And it is a scary example of how crypto can fail and how fail safes and backups have to be in place from both the perspective of the business and the client. So throughout 2018, as Bitcoin prices were crashing, customers of exchanges, especially the exchange Quadriga, reported some kinds of delays and things because people were obviously actively trading and buying and selling. But the customers of Quadriga reported indefinite delays and big problems when they were attempting to withdraw their dollars or any kind of fiat. So let's start in the beginning of 2018, where 25.7 million Canadian dollars were seized from Quadriga CX by the Canadian Imperial Bank of Commerce, or the CBIC. This caused indefinite withdrawal delays for some Quadriga CX customers. While all this was going on, and in the middle of everything that was happening in the courts and what was happening with the Canadian Imperial Bank seizing this money, while all this was going on, the CEO and founder of Quadriga CX, Gerald Cotton, supposedly died in India from Crohn's disease on December 9th of 2018. On the 14th of January 2019, Quadriga announced publicly that their CEO, Gerald Cotton, died the month prior from Crohn's disease while doing volunteer work at an orphanage in India. Now, the official Quadriga CX statement, which was released on Cotton's death, said that he went to India, like I said, to build an orphanage. This statement was later deleted from the Quadriga CX site, but it was saved in an internet archive. It doesn't make much sense in a way that Cotton was building an orphanage while he was in the middle of a court battle, while Quadriga CX customers were suffering due to fiat withdrawal delays. But we'll move on, because dying from Crohn's disease at such a young age is incredibly rare. Not to say it didn't happen, because there is a chance. 1.6% of sufferers from this disease do die of it. And there is nothing concrete about what happened to Gerald's body upon death. There are some sites that state that Gerald Cotton was cremated and his ashes were dumped into a river in India. Yet, in Wikipedia, according to Jennifer Robertson, who was Cotton's widow, he died on December 9th while traveling in India and that she accompanied him to a hospital in Jaipur the previous day and he was diagnosed with septic shock, perforation, peritonitis, and intestinal obstruction. On the 9th, he died after several episodes of cardiac arrest. And on December 10th, a death certificate was issued by the local municipality, as well as a no objection certificate from the police to return the body to Nova Scotia, which of course means that the body should be in Nova Scotia. Robertson filed an affidavit on behalf of the company, which included a statement of death, and a death certificate was attached to the court documents, but it is not an official death certificate. This statement of death is from a funeral home, and apparently, according to Quadriga CX users, they've called this funeral home. And once they did receive an answer, apparently there was no record of Cotton's death. Also in this document, it was stated that Quadriga had 363,000 registered users and a sum of 250 million Canadian dollars, which was owed to 115,000 affected users. But one thing is for sure, Cotton filed a will 12 days before his death. Cotton's will was signed on November 27th, 2018, 12 days before he died. In it, He left his wife, his widow, Jennifer Robertson, as the trustee of a $9.6 million Canadian dollar estate, including an airplane, a sailboat, a Lexus, and real estate, which is spread throughout Canada. There's also an $100,000 Canadian dollar fund to provide lifelong care for Cotton's two dogs. But one thing that was casually forgotten was any information on how to release the $190 million U.S. dollars in user funds that were on his exchange, which only he had sole access to. Because, folks, this is where it gets quite interesting. You see, Cotton had exclusive control of the private keys for 26,488 Bitcoin, 11,378 Bitcoin Cash, 11,149 Bitcoin SV, 35,000 Bitcoin Gold, 199,000 Litecoin, 429,000 Ethereum, with a total value of 190 million US dollars. Quadriga CX claimed in court documents that these funds cannot be recovered. At least they haven't been recovered at this point, since Cotton's laptop that holds the keys is fully encrypted. Of course, when Quadriga shut down, they had 190 million US dollars in cryptocurrency, plus they also had $70 million in Canadian currency, according to court documents. Their exchange enabled trades of Bitcoin, Litecoin, Ether, and other types of cryptocurrency. The largest user's claim was valued at around $70 million US dollars. The company also previously announced that it had filed for creditor protection on its website, but the filing was looking to provide greater details about its predicament, which a little more has been clarified since that date of January 31st. Now, Quadriga CX users are suspicious for multiple reasons, and many users on Quadriga CX's subreddit are calling this a scam. Apparently, Quadriga CX admins are censoring the subreddit, so a new censor-free subreddit was created, and it's been filled with many accusations. There are some people who do believe that his passing was natural. There are many people who do not believe that. Quadriga CX did not publish a list of cold wallet addresses, and users are requesting that Quadriga CX publish a list of addresses to end suspicion. And users are looking for the cold wallet addresses to see if they are truly inactive. And there is a lot of activity on this, so feel free to search on any type of threads, including Bitcoin Talk and some of the others on Reddit, and you can see this for yourself. Now, a cryptocurrency exchange like Quadriga CX should have had the protocol in place to recover cold wallets in the event that Cotton had died, especially knowing that Cotton was traveling all the way to India, regardless of what the reason is. Many users point out that if Cotton was dying from Crohn's disease, that he would have had time to transfer ownership of the cold wallets before his death. But that's just one of the many theories in this whole mystery. Another major issue is that Quadriga CX remained open for deposits for fiat and cryptocurrency well after his death, despite exchange admins having the knowledge that the cold wallets had become inaccessible. Quadriga CX should have suspended deposits immediately upon notice of Cotton's death, instead of waiting for over a month. As of this week, the widow of Gerald Cotton, Jennifer Robertson, has asked a Canadian court to appoint a chief restructuring officer, in part because of the unwanted attention caused by the shuttering of the cryptocurrency exchange. Now remember, Quadriga owes around $197 million in cash and cryptocurrencies, and it's now under creditor protection, while Ernst & Young attempts to unravel the firm's financial dealings through a court process. Quadriga has also asked to extend the period of creditor protection, which is something I'm going to ask Jonathan about in just a moment. Apparently, the money that has been spent so far on entangling this mess is reaching now $500,000 US dollars, and it's only just started, and this is only for legal and accounting fees. Now, Quadriga has been granted an order for creditor protection in the Nova Scotia Supreme Court, and Justice Michael Wood gave the exchange a 30-day stay of proceedings, which ends on March 7th, to search for the missing funds. And Quadriga's lawyers are considering selling the platform if the assets aren't found by that time. So Ernst & Young already posted a notice to creditors on subreddits, as well as also on the website, providing them with information about the proceedings. They also reported that Quadriga did not have, even at that time, a bank account, but instead used third-party payment processors. They apparently had no formal accounting systems, and instead the business was run from Cotton's encrypted laptop from his home in Nova Scotia. But Cotton's laptop was given to lawyers representing the creditors, which will be eventually passed over to Ernst & Young, who are the court-appointed monitors. The computer was previously held by Quadriga CX representatives. So Jennifer Robertson stepped in as a director after her husband's death, along with her stepfather, Tom Beasley, and Jack Martell, who has apparently since resigned. And she has asked for Peter Wedlake, who's a senior vice president and partner with Grant Thornton, to fill in the restructuring role. She has been quoted as saying, "The remaining two directors, being myself and Tom Beasley, have no significant experience in the cryptocurrency industry and no experience with an insolvent company." Furthermore, she said, "The public attention that my role as director has brought is unwanted, and the online commentary which I have reviewed has suggested that I, in particular, am trying to hide assets or am acting contrary to the best interests of the companies, which is not true." So access to Quadriga digital wallets, which is an application that stores the keys to send or receive cryptocurrencies, appears to have been lost with the passing of Cotton. But a podcast from 2014, which was discovered, reveals that Gerald Cotton, Quadriga's CEO, used to store the private keys to cold wallets on paper. So according to Bloomberg, Gerald Cotton said in an interview titled True Bromance Podcast, which was recorded in 2014, that the private keys used to access his exchange's offline wallets are stored on paper. The paper is then left at the bank in a safe deposit box. As a result, even if the keys are lost, access to the wallet is not permanently lost. Cotton had also outlined during this podcast that losing access to a Bitcoin wallet is the equivalent to burning cash. And in his opinion, even the U.S. government with the most sophisticated computers in the world would be unable to gain access to such wallets if the keys are lost, and therefore it's impossible to retrieve the funds held within storage. As is often the case with crypto, this entire episode has now raised speculation everywhere, in online forums, on the street, where people go and gather and talk about crypto. They've wondered out loud if this is a scam, or if there truly is something harrowing in terms of how he had come to pass, and whether the coins are still moving between accounts, and basically just trying to find out what really happened, what may be true, what may be false. It's the legal side of things, because people have been seriously affected by the shutting of Quadriga CX's exchange and the loss of all of this money. If anyone has seen the recent video, which has been floating around the internet, of that poor guy who lost 400 something odd thousand US dollars, your heart just breaks when you see this. And of course, there are all types of amounts which are missing, which I'm sure range from the very small to, like I already said at the beginning of this podcast, 70 million US dollars. So there's a lot of people who have been affected by this, and a lot of people have had life-altering experiences because of the disappearance of these funds. So now I want to first ask you, Jonathan. In the very first instance, we talked about how now Quadriga has filed for creditor protection. Can you go over what that means? What does that mean to everyday man, woman, child, grandfather who has lost their money on Quadriga CX? What does that mean?
So first and foremost, I am not a Canadian lawyer. This is merely for educational purposes. This is not legal advice. This is not investment advice. This is not financial advice. That being said, when a company files for creditor protection, it means that creditors basically need to get in line and not mess with the business process. And what I mean by that is it allows the company, generally speaking, to continue to operate as, you know, necessary, that the creditors that are seeking to have their money or get their pound of flesh from the company that is basically being put in bankruptcy or asking for creditor protection generally means that they are prohibited from filing either multiple suits, so requiring the company to answer multiple suits, or it requires them to kind of go through the process of lining up at the courthouse steps with the appropriate kind of authority, meaning that they have to join kind of a bandwagon if it's a multiple creditor suit, which this is kind of that case where you see these law firms representing hundreds of thousands of traders who have lost monies. And so the creditor protection, it kind of streamlines the process for the most part, and it allows the company to kind of continue to operate to see how things kind of function. It's not like full-blown restructuring. It's kind of this weird middle ground, at least from Canadian law, that I can't speak on, but I'm kind of aware of. And so if any Canadians are listening and I'm getting this wrong, I apologize. But it is my understanding that under Canadian law, this kind of is similar to, you know, just lining up at the door, making sure everybody's complaints are noted, and allowing the company to kind of figure out what's the best step in the next direction, whether that is wrapping up and liquidating everything to pay out investors and traders and creditors, or is it kind of best for things to kind of move forward and actually grow and develop the process out so they can, you know, continue with their obligation to shareholders. In this case, because there is only one director, there is appears to be no other shareholders or any type of investors in the platform that are at least coming out of the woodwork yet. I know he had some early investors, allegedly. And so the creditor protection right now is only for the people who have lost money.
So you were just talking about creditor protection, but apparently they've given the exchange a 30-day stay of proceedings. What does that mean?
That means the exchange as a company has 30 days to get its books, its operations, its everything in order to see what's functioning and what's not. Because this is a unique case in that everything was run from one laptop, doesn't necessarily mean that they can just kind of pop up and create another laptop and get rolling again. And so all of the proceedings, whether they're evidentiary or they're proceedings that kind of lead to hearings that ask kind of what happened and what's going on, they're basically asking for a pause in that to allow Ernst & Young as well as their lawyers to get everything properly ready for the court hearings. And so that's what the stay is for.
Okay. So as you may have been aware of before this podcast or maybe during the podcast, his widow has inherited a significant amount of assets. So it may be the case that Jennifer Robertson has somehow profited from the life savings of the people who have invested into the Quadriga exchange. Can her assets, even though the husband who was the CEO of this company, he's died and he's left these to her in the will, even though technically they're the property of, like I said, the people who lost their life savings, perhaps, are her assets able to be kept with her, or does she have to relinquish them, or what happens there?
That's a great question. Generally, under most common law provisions of the law, which Canadian law would fall under, you are not allowed to benefit from illegal or ill-gotten gain. And so if there is any type of fraudulent behavior on her part, then some of this could be unwound. The question is, and I can't speak to this because I'm not a Canadian lawyer, unfortunately, is whether some of these transactions, specifically the will, could be unwound because of illegal actions by him, by the deceased. And to be quite frank, in most cases, that even in the United States is very difficult because we believe, you know, these wills and trusts and stuff, but, you know, they have significant power, but that doesn't mean the estate can't be sued. And so what would generally happen is instead of her being sued herself, his estate would be sued. And that's kind of where things get really interesting, especially if the body was brought back to Canada. And if it wasn't, you know, there's this whole kind of rabbit hole that we go down, you know, what happened to him. But generally speaking, she is kind of shielded right now, unless there is, and they would have to be evidentiary hearings to prove or at least to establish kind of a baseline of evidence to show that these assets should be frozen until the possible criminal investigation could take place. So it's a very unique situation.
There are a lot of people who are obviously following this, and it's not because they're getting a sense of schadenfreude, you know, where they're happy because they want to see somebody fail. I think a lot of people are looking at this in a number of ways, such as, how can I make sure this doesn't happen to me? Or how are these people going to get their money back? Because, you know, there's 115,000 people who have been directly affected by this. So how are these people themselves? Each person is not going to go out and get a lawyer. So how is each person going to see recompense? How are they going to see something happening towards their favor?
That's a great question. What generally happens in these kind of situations, at least in the U.S., is it's kind of one of those class action settlements that we've all kind of seen. If you've been harmed or you've taken this type of pill and you've had these horrible outcomes, call us at this law firm website or go to this website and sign up. That's kind of what's happening here. The Canadian government has basically set out, these are the, you know, people that are involved, contact them if you have any questions. You know, we'll link to this stuff, I think, if we can. But it's one of those situations where you need to call the law firm and say, I've been harmed, especially if you've been one of these folks who has lost a significant amount of money. That it puts you in line, like I said, for those kind of creditor proceedings. Does that mean you're going to get anything? Does that mean you're going to receive anything? We don't know. Creditor proceedings, generally, they vary tremendously by jurisdiction. I can't speak to the Canadian law, but in the U.S., there's different levels of creditors. And so they would basically have to pay their business expenses and employees and things of that nature first. The good news is it doesn't look like they have any employees or possibly any business expenses, and then they would go down the line. In this case, what would generally happen when it got to these types of uniform creditors, basically everybody in the same class, is whatever was left would basically be divided up. And so you may get pennies on the dollar for your total amount lost, but you would get kind of it's not everybody who gets, you know, signed up first gets the most or gets compensated for their full amount, and then everybody who signed up last gets the least. It's not, you know, everybody who lost the most gets compensated first. It's generally kind of a, well, here's the pot, let's divide it up evenly to the dollar amount for each person who lost, or pennies on the dollar for each person who lost.
This isn't a short process. They've only just started. $500,000 is what has already been spent on lawyers' fees and accounting fees and auditor fees, and I don't even know the rest of the fees. And that's just in the fees to get this sorted. How long do you think something like this can go on? Is this, how long's a piece of string, or how long do you think this is going to go on for?
So that is an excellent question. And of course, the answer is your favorite answer is no. It depends. Well, it depends on a number of things. It depends on what kind of evidence we learned during the process. If for some reason, as numerous people have pointed out, this is a very interesting death. This generally doesn't happen to someone this young. You know, Crohn's disease is a horrible disease, but it generally doesn't take someone this early. There are questions about his wife's background and getting married, I believe, in June, and then him dying in December, and this will 12 days before his death. It is all very circumstantial. It is all very alleged. I cannot say one way or another whether he's dead or alive. I do believe that if it smells fishy, it probably is fishy. But without knowing more of the actual details of the case behind the scenes, I can't say, you know, whether or not who's the guilty party. And it could be something where, in all factual circumstances, this is just a tragedy. This is just some kind of freak accident. But given Quadriga's history and its deep involvement in other kinds of kind of shady stuff that, like I said, is allegedly running around there, none of this stuff is verified yet. But it does appear that Mr. Cotton may have not been in the best of company. And so if that's the case, he may have found himself wanting to flee, wanting to fake his own death, or he may have married someone who wanted him dead because she had financial interest to gain. I cannot attest to that. I have no idea. But the facts of this case are very interesting and very, very compelling that something very bad happened with the finances as well as the death.
Well, we know the SEC is already making steps in terms of making sure that something like this cannot happen. Is there any motion or movement, you think, that will now be taken because of this to ensure that any kind of crypto exchanges have a much better policy or backup plan in place for if something like this happens? Is that something that's legislated upon, or is that something where they don't even deep dive into that because that's maybe not the SEC's or the Canadian equivalent of the SEC's concern? This is another debate of whether or not something like this needs to be heavily government regulated or not. That's a totally different debate. But how will the government going forward do something about this? So at what point does that kind of intervention have to take place to protect the citizens of a country from this happening to them?
Oh, so here's the thing, right? And I love the crypto community, but there are two camps. There are the libertarians, let the world burn, let the world live kind of camp, and that crypto should be crypto and not have any kind of governmental regulations. the R word, the horrible R word. And then there's the kind of more progressive, let's say, understanding of people that want to move this entire industry in this kind of more regulated, more traditional kind of capital markets-esque world. And that's the part of the camp that I'm upon. I truly believe that if there's a multi-million dollar exchange that's transacting in millions of dollars to the point where it's basically laundering money at the back end, and the Canadian government's having to freeze assets, which all of that is true. You know, it's not necessarily laundering money in the legal sense, but it's laundering it through a payment processor by using different shell corporations in order to cash out people. And those types of operations are something that you shouldn't have to do as a normal business. And so when you get to that level of absurdity, you've got to have regulation. I think that everyone who has lost money on this exchange, and there's been so many of them, there's been either a hack or there's been some type of Mt. Gox situation and all of this kind of ridiculousness that continues to happen to the crypto space. And the crypto community still has not learned for the most part. You still hear people about complaining about regulations and all saying, you know, screw the SEC and all this other stuff. But one of the reasons I feel really confident in not only investing and trading on U.S. exchanges is that they have money transmitter licenses. They have to go through different processes that are, as an attorney who helps companies do those processes, they are the most ridiculous, mind-numbing things in the absolute world. Filling out a money transmitter application for 53 jurisdictions is not something I would wish upon my worst enemy. Mm-hmm. And so when you have to deal with things like that, knowing that those applications will be rejected for no apparent reason other than you didn't have enough funds within the company at the time and we excluded certain assets, basically, those types of heartaches and heartbreaks are what gets you to a very powerful, very successful exchange. And whether that's a custodial exchange or a true ATS, that's a whole nother issue. But for everyone who is hurt, and I truly feel for those that have lost, I've myself lost in different types of exchanges that have been compromised. I've had wallets that I have misplaced the keys for, and they will be stuck. Those digital assets will be lost forever. And so I feel for those types of people. I understand that heartache better than most attorneys in this field. But when you cry and complain about regulations and, you know, the R word and all of this other kind of stuff, and then something like this happens where this guy has lost his life savings or, mm-hmm. you know, people that have put their hard earned, whether it's Canadian dollars or US dollars or euro or whatever, you know, they've put their money into the system in the hopes of making life better for themselves. And now they're not able to, all because this guy believed that either he was invincible and he could do it by himself by operating out of a laptop and not having any
fail-safes
form of successions. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Which is a whole nother issue. And I'm going to go off on this diatribe real quick. I don't understand, and this goes back to the suspiciousness of this entire operation, mm-hmm. is in his will, under Clause Y, I believe, it is entitled Digital Assets. And it is one of the first clauses that I have ever seen with a digital asset clause title. And it basically spells out that his estate trustee is supposed to have access and handle all of these electronic and digital assets. And to have that clause in there 12 days before he died, 12 days before whatever happened, that is super suspicious to me. To me, with this guy's knowledge, regardless of whether you believe him or not, whether he died or not, he put someone in control of these keys.
Do you think that that's because his lawyer drafted this will and he knew that he had digital keys? He had digital assets? Possibly,
but I think there's probably 30 lawyers in the U.S. that handle digital assets, that understand what digital assets are. And so to have a clause like that, to have him make those statements previously, right? And don't get me wrong, I get it that he's got a laptop and, you know, everything's on there. But we all know that if he's got all the exchanges and everything set up through AWS, he can basically access everything through the cloud anyway. And so he can get access to most of these wallets anywhere in the world as long as he's got the private key. And mm-hmm. so here's the real rub. is that lawyer would know what happened in that transaction. And that lawyer, in theory, could possibly break attorney-client privilege, at least under U.S. law, but they would need court permission. And that is the multi-million dollar question of, were their private keys given to the lawyer? Because the lawyer would, at this point, would have an obligation to come forward. Or is the lawyer aware that the wife has private keys? And granted, under this clause, she should not have them at this point because he is not deceased when this document was executed. But if Cotton had the foresight to put this in, regardless of whether it was his lawyer or not, he saw this clause, he had this podcast, he knew what kind of assets he was in charge of. Mm-hmm. I imagine somewhere he put the keys or some type of fail-safe, regardless of whether it was industrial regulated fail-safe. It clearly wasn't, right? There was no, you know, form of succession for another director to basically take over and start running operations. But to have a clause like this, like I said, in your own personal will and not have the personal keys either given to your lawyer, which is kind of what most lawyers are doing right now in this space, is holding a set of the crypto keys, which is terrifying for lawyers. And most of the lawyers that do it tell me this. Or did he or she know where the keys were safeguarded? That is questions that, unfortunately, we don't know yet. And I believe, at least under, like I said, under U.S. law, that attorney would have an obligation to come to the court and say, you know, we believe that the keys are here, whether they're for the keys for his own assets or the keys for the exchange is an entirely different question, right? Because it says these assets as his electronic digital assets. So they could be intermingled with Quadriga's assets, which would in turn be intermingled with the client's assets or all these traders' assets that have been lined up as creditors. Or it could just simply be this is his hard wallet or cold wallet that has $400 in Bitcoin. Who knows? Like it could have little or nothing. But to have this clause in there, like I said, is very unique. The lawyer is probably, if not already, has already talked to someone in the accounting firm or they've probably had some sort of discussion about how all of this kind of has taken place. And I think that's probably one of the reasons they've asked for a stay to figure out, you know, what are the ethical obligations for the lawyer involved. One of the obligations of the trustee or executor, as we call it in some states, is to basically audit everything first, because you've got to have an idea of what you have and then who you have to pay out and then who you have to basically give money to, right? Because if I have a personal line of credit that's $100 million and that eats up all of my assets, then guess what? So sorry, so sad to my beneficiaries. But if I have a $1 million indenture and, you know, my estate can cover that, and then it, all of the other distributions have to go to my heirs or my beneficiaries or whoever's in trust.
So what I can say, I think on behalf of both Jonathan and myself, is that we feel so bad for what's happened to everybody that this has happened to. But this has been another week of Crypto and Blockchain Talk. Thank you for tuning in and listening to our podcast. It's one of these podcasts where we're very interested in finding out how something like this can be rectified in the future, what possible solutions can happen out of this, either from the government standpoints, perhaps, or from the companies themselves, and how they will go forward to prove in a very concrete way how they will take care of the assets of people, the cryptocurrencies, the accounts of people once they have invested. And we just hope that everybody has learned something from this podcast. Jonathan, I'd like to thank you so much for joining us for this week's edition of Crypto and Blockchain Talk.
Thank you so much. And I would like to reiterate that
thanks for listening to the CryptoCast very podcast.
Sympathetic to anybody
stay
who's lost
tuned for more
funds.
Episodes.
I have myself, like I said, have lost funds in various means of exchange and private wallets being locked up in all kinds of silly ways and things of that nature. And so as a crypto community, as a blockchain community, we simply just have to learn and grow from this together as a united front and really kind of track down, you know, the bad actors in this space. And unfortunately, whether it was intentional or not, Mr. Cotton was a bad actor.
I agree. So thank you again, everyone, for listening to this week's edition. And you can download us on iTunes, Spotify, Podbeam, and Stitcher. Please don't forget to leave us also some great comments on Twitter and Facebook. And if you have any questions, you can email us at education@savvydigital.com. That's education@savvydigital.com. So thank you again for tuning in and have a really great day. Goodbye.
Thanks for listening to the CryptoCast podcast. Stay tuned in for more episodes.